Welcome to this session. It's called Digits in the Archive. My name is Jerry Faber, so I'm going to be acting as the chair. First up, we have George Blood, who will speak for 55 minutes, and then Aaron Biddle will speak for about a half hour. George Blood is a veteran of over 4,000 live recordings, including 21 years with the Philadelphia Orchestra. He's earned 3 Grammy nominations. He started the Safe Sound Archive Company in 1990 to manage his 4,000 recordings. And the Safe Sound Archive now processes 1,000 hours of archival material per month of collections from around the country. His talk is titled, Bits is Bits, right? And this looks at what happens to the digital bit stream from the time it leaves the A to D converter until it arrives or doesn't arrive in the file.
All right. Normally, I like to take questions during the presentation. We ask people to hang on till the end because a lot of the questions that people have been peppering me with are things that I get to eventually in the presentation. But if I completely lose anybody at some point, flag me and we'll try to pick up the pieces. I'm juggling a little bit of fairly technical presentation with what I know is an audience that has a lot of people with a little less technical background. So we'll see how I manage that balance. This represents in very coarse terms, you know, a very simple diagram of an audio digitization workflow. And we're going to look at this section here from the output of the A to D converter. So we're not talking about analog setup or all the myriad of topics there or the nuances of A to D conversion. I'll mention up here that the things that are presented here are largely independent of the sample rate. So the problems we're finding happen at both 44.1, 48, and 96K. And all the stuff that happens through the workstation until it's actually written to the file. And once you get to the file, life becomes much simpler because then you can throw data tools, checksums, MD5s, at the files to keep track of their integrity. But what happens in between? And whereas this diagram is actually fairly simple, there's a whole lot that's going on in there. And there are any number of people in this room who may find a weakness or an objection to this list. It's just intended to be I'll give you a sense of the order of magnitude of the number of times the data is handled or discussed between components from the time it leaves the A to D converter until it finally ends up in the file. And with all that going on, you know, lots of opinions about what should be happening in a given moment in time. I'm also going to divulge what I expect to be the greatest disappointments by the time I'm done, namely, I don't mention brands very much. And this is by design because we ended up undertaking this study because we needed to find something that would work for us. And the study isn't meant to be at all exhaustive. So if we found a problem that we couldn't overcome, we probably just, you know, meandered somewhere else trying to take the path of least resistance to find a configuration that worked in our circumstance so that we don't go around dissing a lot of the household brands that we're handling here, although I will show you everything that we did work with. And I'm not gonna tell you what our solution is because our solution is very particular to our configuration and it's, there aren't gonna be too many places that are gonna be working in the kind of environment where we have a large number of ingest stations, you know, central storage, we have a remote machine room, lots of factors, and also our solution ended up being fairly complicated, so that divulging our solution, which I'm ready to talk to anybody about one-on-one, wouldn't actually give you very much information, except that if you look long and hard and try hard enough, you can actually solve these problems. So going back a step, these problems are perhaps solvable on in other ways. This is going to invoke Mike Casey's equifinality. There may be more than one solution. We found something that worked for us. And this is staggeringly prevalent. We ran probably a few thousand tests. We were at this for about 5 months and tested an enormous number of files under an enormous number of circumstances. The failure rate of the problems that we're seeing is north of 85%. This is happening all the time, enough that I could probably predict that everybody in this room either has or is creating files with this problem. Very briefly, we're going to run down some of the stuff that we were looking at. Before anybody gets too excited, I took care to list these alphabetically, not to give any preference to any one of them. So there's the range of hardware we looked at, a wide range of software applications that we were working with, a lot of different operating systems, and the drivers. And the drivers are actually probably the key to a lot of the solutions to these problems. But it's getting the right driver into the right circumstance was one of the challenges that we were dealing with. We also looked at a lot of different storage configurations to look at whether things like drive speed and formatting, whether the Macs or the PCs were behaving better or worse. And this is also an important thing that I want to mention of stuff that we didn't look at. Again, this wasn't meant to be an exhaustive study. I hadn't even planned to do a presentation like this. After we started seeing enough of this, that I thought it would be valuable information to share. Some of these things I would have definitely wanted to have included in a more comprehensive study. As I'll come back to later, things like AudioCube and PureMix, the integrated solutions, have a lot going for them. Bias Peak didn't get used because two of my engineers adamantly refused to ever handle that program ever again. This could also simplify some of the issues, reducing the number of links in that processing chain is important. But again, this is where our situation different enough that we couldn't use that. Namely, we have a central machine room, so all our computers are down the hall with all the storage. And it's wonderful because all the noise and the hard drives is isolated. But we wanted to keep the A to D converter as close to the analog source as possible for monitoring and setup and cable length. So this is what we started out with. Maybe 20 different workstations. So the plan was that we would take the signal coming out of an A to D converter, send it to multiple workstations concurrently, and then compare those files and see what came out. And they would all have a different configuration, and we would find the ones that passed and the ones that would fail. And in this case, the capital letters may be an operating system, and the lowercase letter would be a program, and the number would be the hardware that you're using. And you set up a set of simultaneous equations, and you can figure out, what's working and what's not working. And I have a pretty good science background, and my head of QA had a minor in physics. So this is pretty high school algebra stuff. This wasn't going to intimidate us at all. So let's talk about how we went about finding the errors. Listening actually is a very bad way to go about doing this, although our ears are very sensitive, they're also very easily fooled. And it would be extremely inefficient. We're processing enormous number of files, and so if you have three systems, like I had in the previous slide, creating a one-hour file, somebody's going to listen for 3 hours and try to find a random event in one of those files. It's also extremely unreliable because it doesn't take a whole lot for you to be distracted or to differentiate between a click that's caused by an error in the file versus something that really may be acoustic, much less if you're doing disk transfers. Software verification lacks the means of knowing whether something is actually correct. If you ask the computer, a program, is this a 24-bit file? It'll say, yep, it's 24 bits. But is it the 24 bits that I sent? And that you can't do directly with the software. We also found that there were limits to the parameters that you could test. And things like Wavelab has a routine. You remember what it's called, Michael?
Global analysis.
Global analysis. That will find lots of sites that are benign. So if you're trying to compare the files, what's it comparing it to? So we needed something more reliable. And what we used was a null test. And it would be great if the files in two computers were absolutely identical, but simple things like starting two workstations at exactly the same time, it has to be exactly the same time, with exactly the same sample, wasn't going to happen. So, but you start with two presumably identical files. You align them up to the sample, invert the polarity of one of them, and then you add them together. I'm going to show this in greater detail. But philosophically, we're looking at if this file matches this file, if we subtract this file from this file, the output should be zero. And that's what we're using to run all these tests. And if it's not zero, what is it? What is the artifact that's coming out of it? I'm going to show you a series of slides. You can see that there are two files. These are stereo pairs, left, right, left, right. Like this isn't rocket science anymore. Everybody's familiar that amplitude is vertical and time left to right. There's a timeline across the top. So this is, 5 minutes of sound. And you can see that these are the same program. Happens to be different programs on the left and right channel. And using a successive approximation, we just go in, look closer and closer and closer. This is a screenshot of a Sonic Solutions workstation, leaving aside all the bells and whistles and reputation and expense of a system like this. This is being used because it happens to do this one thing really, really well. So it's really easy to run the null tests on that. So rather than being an advertisement for Sonic, it just happens to be that this tool was very fast. We could do one of these null tests in about 30 seconds. But other software applications are capable of doing this too. So here we've gone down a little bit more, and we're just getting progressively tighter and tighter, trying to find some event in the two files that we can line to. We're just slipping them back and forth against each other, going down, looking in higher and higher resolution, looking at less and less information, until you can see here we're looking at the individual bits, and this lines up with this. I can't reach the top one, sorry. So those two files are lined up in time together. And then we're just going to take one pair and invert it. So you can see the first panel there trends up, and this third panel trends down. And then we play these back simultaneously. So we do a four-channel playback, and since this one's inverted, this is subtracted from the first one and the second one from the fourth one. And ideally what would come out is nothing. As in nothing, nothing, as in flat line. And we're testing for two parameters that are stored in the PCM audio stream. Time, which is a simple matter of counting the number of samples. So that if you feed 96,000 samples in, you should get 96,000 samples out. And if the other file's got 95,999, one of the samples has gone missing. And then we're looking at amplitude, which is the number of bits, and where, if anywhere, there's a discrepancy between the two files. Typically, in these tests, we'll find a difference between the files, but you have to do further analysis to know which file is the one that, or what's different about one file from the other. Which one actually got the 24 bits, which one has all the samples, and we'll see how that's done. To give you a sense for the efficiency of this test, I took a sample, and I duplicate this file at the finder level in the Mac, and invert the file. So we're dealing with files that are known to be identical. And then I took them, lined them up, and then offset it by a single sample. So this 23 microseconds of offset when I ran these two, and you can see there's a fairly substantial output as opposed to this flat line here. This is what we're looking for, where absolutely positively nothing comes out. I'm also going to point out at this stage that you can see that there's not nothing coming out, but there's a fair amount of activity there. So the issue of what comes out is important because it tells you other things about what's happening in the process. Here's a screenshot. For the sake of this simplicity here, this is a mock. It's actually just two left channels. You can see here, these are aligned and they're running along perfectly happy. Here's the event where something has happened. And rather than these files, these bits merely being offset in amplitude, there's a chunk of time missing because you can see that these two are no longer running concurrently, but this event, larger event here, you can see that the files are again accurate. So this yellow band here is a, we can measure this time. And I set the display here rather than in minutes and seconds to read individual samples. And on the upper left here, you see that there's an offset there somewhere along the line. 74 samples have gone missing. Curiously, this is a number we saw fairly regularly. It doesn't multiply out to anything in particular. It's not like it's, you know, 4,096 samples, some logical block. We happen to know that because we asked that the program and our storage are running in 32K storage blocks. It's nothing close to that. We don't know where that's coming from. So along the way, we found lots of things, but we haven't discovered what the source of the problems are, just that they're there. And this you would probably be hard-pressed to hear. This is a very small event. The largest ones we saw where there was missing data would run into the seconds. You'd lose about five seconds, which is, you know, on the order of 400,000 samples. And this is just 76. So this is a fairly sensitive test. We can find very small events. And here is a representation of a binary word that's 16 bits. And just taking a look at these two, you know, there's one bit's different in the middle. Now, how significant is that? Well, actually, numerically, not very significant, but, you know, we're preservationists. We would like to know that what we put in is what's coming out. And if we look at this, you know, indefinitely into the future, we would like to know that the bits that we put in are coming out. As small as that error is looking at just a single word, if you take a file of any size, you could take a 2-hour 9624 file, that would fail an MD5 checksum. Yeah, the checksums are that sensitive. But we haven't gotten to that point. We don't know. We don't even know that we're sending the data in. We don't know that the data being written to the drive is what we're sending in. So, but we can actually see this. And here's an example. The top two are one pair. He's a matching pair from another workstation. And along here, we've got this single event. That's one sample out of place. So that I don't know which bit it is. You know, whether it's, you know, 23 or 18 or number 3. But the tests are quite sensitive to even very, very small events. That's one bit in one sample out of place. It is not possible to hear that. This is a philosophical, we seek perfection because it's a really great place to be, whether or not you can hear it. We also ran this set of examples looking at how small it is big enough to be seen in an amplitude change. Now, the engineers in here will appreciate the fact that, you know, this is digital. I mean, if the gain is the same, they should match between the two files. But if you were to try to do a test like this with two analogs inputs, so that you're comparing, say, A to D converters, getting a perfect gain match between two devices is not going to happen. So to demonstrate how big how small a difference can still be seen using a null test. I ran four tests. I, again, duplicated a file, inverted one so that we can run the null, and then changed the gain on one pair by astonishingly small amounts. The largest one here is a thousandth of a dB difference. And the one on the far right is 1/10,000th of a dB of change. So, you know, vanishingly small differences in gain, and we still see output. So the difference between this is 1/10,000th of a dB difference and nothing is the broadside of a barn. And I'm going to draw your attention to these numbers because they'll mean something more to you in a little while. That's 82, 93, 98, and 104. So we have what prompted all of this was we were growing, we were looking at workflow, and we decided that it was time to change the way we were doing things, not just for the sake of change, but just to improve the efficiency of our throughput. And we had invested in a large, very large amount of new hardware, but we didn't just want to put this in production. We wanted to actually test whether the hardware was doing what we were told it would do. And so we started running these tests very matter-of-factly, and just figured we were just going to go through a couple of weeks of shakedown, be sure that, you know, all the cables were patched in the right place and everything was working. So what happened? I don't know why they'd advanced two slides, but within all the new hardware, every single test failed. Absolutely positively, every single test that we ran. So, being somewhat dejected, I called a close friend of mine who's an electrical engineer and went through him with him. This is what we're doing. You know, what am I missing? This looks like we've just screwed up setting something up somewhere. And he found a few tweaks about our test procedures and the way our hardware was set up for the testing, and we went back and we changed all that, and again, even after that review, somebody looked at the stuff, and absolutely positively, every file was failing. We then went back, sorry, this is only supposed to advance one at a time, right? We went back to our old workstations that were still sort of in production. This is standard desktop, you know, one workstation hooked up to one A to D converter doing one file at a time, and reviewed them, and we found those files were all failing. So this is very depressing at this point because, you know, we're creating lots of files and we can't certify bit accuracy of the files. We were going quite gray, figuring something was amiss here. We were missing something. This looks like a fundamental fault. And so we went back and pulled, looking at ever simpler and simpler configurations until we finally got some passes. But we couldn't get any of the systems to pass consistently. But we did finally see some genuine nulls, and we knew that the testing procedure had validity, but we were finding two identically configured computers that were ordered at exactly the same time, came in, ordered the hardware at the same time, you know, installed the same software. We did bare metal reinstalls on the computers. And we couldn't run two systems side by side and get nulls every single time running down the line. So we decided we had to look for a different way to run the tests. And instead of running this series of simultaneous equations to find which was the single component in that chain across multiple workstations was giving us the failure, we decided we needed to qualify a control. I needed to get to the point where I could have a workstation where I would record and knew things were right. And once we had this baseline, then we could put another workstation up next to it and change one thing until we would find, this is the problem, this is what's going wrong. And we did this with a simple round-robin test that we started with three systems, and if A and B don't null, and B and C don't null, but A and C do, then we know the problem's with B. So this is, you know, much simpler arithmetic to try to find and qualify the system. But, you know, having seen hundreds of failed files across many different workstations, where were we going to look for the control? And we looked around, you know, this is the assumption that we have only one variable at play in trying to shake down the control in the round robin test. Jerry said at the beginning, I still do a lot of production work. So in addition to the archival work, we're doing new recordings. So we have some other tools at our disposal that work less well in a preservation environment. And specifically, we were looking at the Sonic Solutions workstations and the Nagra 5. And Sonic is a great editor, but it's a pain in the butt in a preservation environment because of the proprietary file sizes or file types, and you can't export as a WAV file, and certainly no AES 31 ADL support. It just is not a tool that we use for preservation. The Nagra has this, like Sonic, this great reputation for its integrity. It's an extremely simple box, and we also couldn't change anything. If this was going to work, then we couldn't, miss a setting somewhere. So we decided to pull these in, trying to create an environment where we could run the null tests. So instead of working with these workstations, which we were tearing our hair out about, we use these two tools, take the output of an analog to digital converter, and send to Sonic Studio and the Nagra 5 at the same time. Every test passed. There was great rejoicing throughout the land. Most importantly, it validated our testing procedure. We knew that there wasn't just something screwy going on in the way we were testing the files, but here we were able to create an environment where we had a control. We had something we could compare against. And we're actually fairly lucky, again, as we get into this, because I got three of the Nagra 5s and two of the Sonics, so that we could continue to throw a lot of tests at these in a comparatively short period of time. And like I said, the thing that took the longest amount of time is getting the files over to Sonic, off the Nagras, over the network, into Sonic, and then 30 seconds later, we knew whether we had a pass or a fail. This is another one of those issues where our solution is probably not applicable for most environments. I have a pretty good talent pool to throw at tests like this. This is the volume of talent we had running for about 5 months running these tests that we found a solution. And we were consulting with, real engineers as opposed to us people who call ourselves recording engineers, these people with, like degrees and stuff. Notice what's missing from that list very conspicuously. Tech support at the manufacturers. It was universally, hysterically appalling. You call them and they had these amazingly short attention spans. Of course it's some other component in it. We got one workstation working with a sound card and we were getting audio in, we change applications and the files would start failing again. All right, so you call the tech support and says, there's gotta be a setting somewhere. What are we doing wrong? And you explain to them, it's like, when we run your competitor's program, everything's fine. We run yours, there's a problem. It says, there's something in your setup. That's the sound card. Rewind this. We have a configuration that works with a different software. We'd like to use your software, but we have this problem. There's a problem with the sound card. And that didn't go on for very long before we gave up on that. That was a great disappointment. And it is possible. There are some really good people who work for these companies. It's really hard to get hold of them to try to shake these problems down. Another lesson here. We're talking about computer traps. Traps are a philosophy in programming where, you get this program, it's got 16 million lines of code, and every once in a while something really awful happens. And if you go and try to find it, you're probably going to, sprout half a dozen more bugs. How do you deal with this? So you write more code, and the code sits there and it watches for this evil thing to be about to happen. And when it happens, it says, do this instead. These are fairly common, and depending on the nature of the problem, it could be a really efficient way to solve a coding problem to fix bugs. You don't want your code to be all traps, all bug traps instead of repairs, but depending on the magnitude of a problem, this is a perfectly valid solution. But you can also use this to just sort of sweep things under the carpet. I'm disappointed that I didn't actually think, because this is early in the process, we found these. And these are random events. You know, the slides that I'm showing are things that, you know, this is good enough to take a picture of. I missed this one. We had a couple of files where they were clearly aware that something awful had happened and there was a crossfade. And you would see this because it would be big enough that the problem, a glitch started in the word but finished in the silence after it. You could see that there wasn't a little spike there when you expect an offset in the amplitude of the waveform. They just like sort of rubbed it all out, smoothed it over, and it looked pretty. But we found perhaps more significant, we'll generously call them lies. Again, reviewing, here we have two files, and these actually genuinely do null. So you can get this absolutely flat line between them. This is a fun one I caught along the way. This is about 20 seconds of audio, and you can see there's a little blip in the display. Another pat on the back for Sonic. Their waveform displays are really great. And so we can see a small event like that. And if we zoom into that, this is looking at now just a few seconds. This event is about 1.5 seconds long. Something's come along. It's probably a speed problem or left hand talking to right hand. I have to keep going. And it's lost track of what was going on and picked up. This is completely inaudible. But you know, these are the kinds of little things. This probably I would have turned my head around and just shrugged my shoulders at. This is just a novelty. But here's an incomplete null. Again, we've got two files at the top, and I don't know how obvious this is, but there's actually a signal here. There's a waveform on this, and although it's flat, it's very large. It's not that flat line that we're looking for. And for some bizarre reason, again, we haven't been able to figure this out, although Rob Perretti from QTech had a really interesting suggestion last night that I'm trying to follow up on. But you see that there's like something happening here, and there's a lot of something happening here. And this is one of the most common artifacts that we observed. And this is just a closer look at it with a little better contrast. On the display on the left-hand side, this is decibels below full scale. So zero is full scale, and ideally there would be nothing here because it would just be this flat line. So there's something about 90 dB down going on. So trying to figure out what that is and how big, what's the order of magnitude? How big is this error? Because the display doesn't have a lot of resolution. It's something around 90 dB, but I want to know something better than that. So we take that different signal and normalize it. And in sonic normalizing, we'll take the highest amplitude bit in the area that you're working on and turn it up to zero. So you get the maximum gain. One bit is equal to 6 decibels. And you take the normalized gain divided by 6, and you can see where in all of those bits, this is a 24-bit file, something has happened. And you divide 90 by 6 and get 15 bits. As we zoomed in and looked closer, you saw it looked like just a big flat bar across. But if you look at closer and closer resolution, you can see it's actually a modulated signal. If I go in even farther, you could actually see the waveform going all the way up and down across several bits here. And then what I've done is I've taken this area, which is about a second, and done a Fourier transform. I've done a frequency analysis of it, which is what's here. And this is DC, that's in this display is going to be 20K, and it's broadband noise. The signal, unlike what we saw in the gain changes and the offset by one bit, they're highly correlated to the input signal. This is highly uncorrelated. This broadband noise is what the output is. That doesn't happen by accident. And if you take this file, it's been amplified by 90 dB, you can turn the volume up, and play it back, it sounds like. It's not passing the 24 bits. And what it appears to be doing is that somewhere in the chain, the 24 bits is being truncated to 16 bits, because 16 bits is an easier data block to handle. And then rather than just writing the 16 bits, you're not going to write a 16-bit file to the computer, right? You told the computer you wanted a 24-bit file. So it's going to write a 24-bit file out, but it's not just going to pad it out to zeros, because you'd find that. That's actually fairly much easier to find. They need to modulate the other 8 bits that they've tossed away and give you something back so that it looks like your file's getting there. So what they've done is they've tethered the signal. And you're getting this broadband noise out. This is highly repeatable. And so they've chopped off the last 8 bits along the way, and then before they write the file at the other end of the DSP, in our case, which is no processing, they just dither the signal back out to 24 bits. In this series of tests, I'm looking at what is the threshold? What's hard about the process? And we have, I've highlighted here some of the notes that we're making in the file to keep track of. And that's a 24-bit file, this is 20 bits, and this is 16 bits. So, well, maybe if we just send them 20 bits, that'll be enough. What would be the difference in output? As it turns out, we see the same pattern. We see the same dither signal. Even at 20 bits, the files are being truncated at 16 bits. And then re-dithered at the output. What's happened here? Well, we're only giving it 16 bits, but there's an awful lot of output here. And what's happened here is whatever it's struggling to keep up with from a data rate, it drops samples. And this probably dropped an awful lot of samples for it to be that much amplitude. I took that last those last three files. And the first two we have normalized, the last one we did. So to give you a sense of amplitude, that one that we saw in the last slide is really only that big. But again, it's not a flat line, it's a correlated signal. And there is broadband noise happening. What's interesting about this example is that this one's actually, we'll call it properly dithered. In the earlier samples, we were seeing that huge DC offset where everything was happening on the positive side above the x-axis. This one's actually properly dithered around the x-axis. This is rare. That one I'm going to find out. I'm going to find out what it is that causes that offset, because that's actually the largest problem that we saw. Another sample. We're actually doing the Fourier transform again. You can see it's perfectly flat amplitude in the frequency domain for this broadband noise, which you can see modulated here, but that it does cross the x-axis symmetrically. Here's some other novelties. This is a single bit toggling. Who knows why? But you can see it just goes every periodic. It almost made it. That one has no noise spectrum. And this was the piece de resistance. This is the one that I made particular care. I only saw this once. I would not claim to be able to repeat this particular example. This is the same display, it's just on the higher resolution. I've increased the amplitude. But you can see, here we really do have a flat right channel, but the left channel is not. It was actually in this display, there's three samples. It's only the middle one that we're concerned about. I trimmed up the display for this. So I took this output and normalized it. Well, normalization requires a multiplication, and this is zero. And digital audio doesn't deal with zero real well. So when we actually have the nulls, we get this absurdity that comes out, that the file is zero and the normalization is to turn it down by 200 decibels. So that's a rounding error in the DSP out, you know, 8 or 9 decimal places. But, you know, nothing moves. You don't get this big fat display. And the other channel we see is at 94 and change. So that we have different output in the left and right channel in this sample. And if you remember our arithmetic of taking that and dividing it by 6, it's just shy of 16 bits. So somebody has had the forethought to use triangular probability dither at 1/2 LSB. In this case, least significant bit is 16 bits, but they're padding out the 24-bit word at 1/2 the 16-bit level. And there it shows. These are some more of the absurdities we saw along the way. One of my engineers had an I/O box that he had used for years, loved, so we figured we would try that. So I got dealer to send me another one, and this is one of the side-by-side comparisons we did. And the two hardwares, you know, the same box, gave us different results. We have the same configuration, would give us different results on different days. This was particularly troubling that we would get one system that would randomly sample rate convert the input. So, all right, let's see how you're behaving. You run a 1-minute sample, run the null, all right, it's behaving. And you go back, run the whole hour, and find out that the file had been sample rate converted at the input. It's like, there's no buttons to click on for this. We're feeding it a, you know, really rock solid clock input, and this one system would give us this absurd output. I couldn't hear it. Here are some very, very broad conclusions. There's a really high correlation between what you spend on the hardware and software and what you get. It's just so easy to build these traps and to mask things that that's often the easier way to build the code. The drivers are a very, very important part of the process, and whatever you do, go to the website, you know, just put a tickler on your calendar for the first of the month and go and look and see if there's an update on the driver, particularly if there are any changes in the operating system. The non-host-based systems performed markedly better. And this is all the way back to one of my early slides. This is where I wished that AudioCube and Pyramix had been part of our tests, because, you know, the Sonic delivered 100% results. Sonic is mysteriously crash happy, and I respect that so much more, because it, from what I can tell here, somebody made a decision philosophically that if I can't do it, I'd rather crash than hide that. Whereas most of these other ones just sweep it under the carpet somehow. But the better the integration between the hardware and the software, if you can go to one manufacturer for all of that, things behave a lot better. This is a very broad statement that I don't want people to get too hung up on. We found generally fewer problems with the Mac-based systems under OS X, and I believe I'm gonna ascribe that to Core Audio. The Macintosh operating system understands audio and takes a lot of the heavy lifting off the code for the application and handles that at the operating system. So we see generally, but not absolutely, better results. Don't buy a Mac just because you think it's going to be better. It's more complicated than that. But our trend found that the Mac, we were able to shake down the Mac applications better. And the absurdities that we saw in the Mac applications. We were looking at things like Audacity and Boom. You know, Boom only records. I looked for the simplest application I could find, and it failed. It's like, it doesn't have to do anything else except the data here and put it here. And it's a Mac application. Even that couldn't happen. And I'm entirely convinced these problems are extremely widely known by the manufacturers. And I think I'm going to stop there and take questions. Yes?
Have you presented this at a place like AES or a more scientific community?
You're my first time.
Do you plan to?
We'll see who else we can roll this out to.
Okay.
What? You're doing quite well.
Yeah, well, I had a lot of practice. There were a couple of instances back, I didn't want to stop the ball game, where you said there as opposed to our, and I wasn't sure what your source was for there. This relates to signal input. Were you using somebody else's recording, or were you referring to somebody else's piece of equipment? I was really confused about that.
Would you rec?
Yeah, I'll recommend it. Not quite that fast. I can't read that fast. If we go to the following one. The one with the three in it. This was the dither one.
Yeah, there are two sets of dither. This one's actually properly dithered. Mm-hmm. It's symmetrical around the x-axis.
Now, there was one where you went, the first one you went back to 16, where you found the 16 code.
This one?
Yeah, that must be it. Yeah. You said that their signal, if I'm correct, remember correctly, that their signal led to the dip. I just don't remember your precise wording. What confused me here was what
was the
this is nothing argument. That you generated yourself that came from an exterior source?
Oh, some of these earlier ones, some of the tests we ran for the examples, we were just literally take any random file and duplicate it, so that by definition they should match.
So these weren't files that you generated yourself, or the control conditions, but the things that you imported from.
Most of these files, we have an ADD converter. Mm-hmm. We take the output of the ADD converter and send the same AES31 bit stream to multiple workstations, mm-hmm. and record the results.
Mm-hmm. But you said there as if it were a less controlled source or a less measured source. I was a little confused by that.
Well, let's look at the slides after, and we'll go over that. Yes?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but interpreting what you're saying, these errors that you were discovering through the null test are often the result of the duplication process of digital files?
No. By duplicating a file,
yes.
Take a file and make a copy of it, we're able to test some of our procedures because we know it's absolutely positively the same thing. It's when you send the same data stream to more than one workstation, they don't write the same information to the file. And they should be absolutely identical.
So this is a cautionary story, and don't do that.
No. Because the act of sending it to multiple workstations isn't what causes the problem. What happens is that we have the same bit stream running to more than one workstation, and they're doing something to the files, either in amplitude or the number of samples, creating this difference. And they're actively trying to hide some of the weaknesses. Gary.
George, have you done anything to determine whether or not if you send the same data stream to two different workstations and the only difference of what gets recorded is a difference in clock jitter, in other words, no difference in the actual numbers itself, but a difference in the jitter levels, does that affect your ability to get a null?
Jitter shouldn't influence this at all because it's just a data stream at this point. Because we're doing nothing that derives clock out of the data. The clock is the clock information is not embedded in the data stream.
Okay.
Time is embedded, but not the time base. Yeah.
Question about the slide where you mentioned using Sonic Studio. I always get confused with Sonic. Is that Sonic Solutions HD or SoundWave?
In this case, it happened to be HD. But you can.
So you're doing all this on Mac System 9s?
Yes.
Well, the null testing, yes.
No, I meant the slide where you were comparing something specific in doing it in Sonic Solutions and one other program.
Well, were you in Sonic Solutions and the Nagra 5 were qualified to be a control. We found with sufficiently high reliability, in excess of four nines, that we were able to send data to those two systems and they would match. That allows us to compare something else. We trust that these systems have demonstrated that the data we send to them is what they record to the file. So you compare that to another system, and if it doesn't match, our control is understood to be either the Naga or the Sonic.
I guess my question is for people who want to rely on some of this. NAC System 9 is not really supported anymore, and
that
isn't really supported anymore.
This is where I don't mention the manufacturers. The Sonic HD is being used in this set. It wasn't being used as one of our controls. We were using the Nagras because from a workflow standpoint, it was much easier. The Sonic running in OS 9, the Sonic Studio HD, was being used because it was really fast to do the null tests. Brett?
Yeah, when you mentioned that you were happy that the Sonic system crashed versus another system that didn't crash and kind of pushed it under the rug.
Yeah.
Specifics on what that other system was that pushes it under the rug?
All of them.
All of them.
This is where I don't want to get too much into brands, because I suspect that if you spend enough time with these other applications, you could probably shake these problems down. But looking at a random sample of combinations of commonly used applications and hardware, you can't just plug this stuff in and go. It fails. It takes active participation and these tests to find out whether it's actually working, because the software won't tell you that I'm lying. And we'll go back here. This is going back to my list of stuff that we looked at. That's what we didn't look at. But among the applications and the hardware, this is all very, very commonly used stuff. And we had problems with all of this stuff, and a lot of problems with a lot of it. This wasn't just some random thing that we found. We were mixing these combinations up. And like I said, you take a Lynx card and SoundForge and WaveLab, and you get different results on the same workstation. Yeah?
Besides relevant tech support, have you reported any of this to any of the companies?
If you can get past tech support, I know personally know the guys at Sonic, and they were a bit of a help, but it's always, the problem was with others' software. But we weren't able to get through any, we would find the regional sales reps were pretty good, because, we were installing 15 systems. They were interested in solving this problem. And then you might get an engineer on the phone for 10 minutes and never be able to get hold of the guy again. This is not a problem. This is like a lone voice in the wilderness, and they're selling hundreds of systems a day. But only one, people aren't looking for this. Because, having the tools to look, who has the tools to look for this? I'm sure Bruce will go back and talk to David, and they'll run some tests and go, whew. But who else does? You can go back and run some tests. Seth?
All right. Now, with all of these problems that you found, what does a studio or an institution do? You're going to do a job for a client, right? We're all shrugging our shoulders, trying to keep some sort of audio integrity. And this is proving that, we're sitting here scratching our heads. What we're delivering, is it actually, guaranteed? We can, and then essentially, we have to say...
I'm going to answer that philosophically.
Okay.
If nobody has been hearing this stuff over how many years, are we really focusing on the most critical parameters?
That was my question.
Yes.
You're here. George?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are probably sitting here wondering, well, if that one bit that changed is not audible, why are we even worrying about it? But a lot of institutions are talking about periodic data migration to a new medium. You're storing stuff on hard drives. 2 years later, you migrate it to another set of hard drives. And 2 years later, you migrate it again. And by the time you've migrated it four times, there may be a very much an audible difference between the original and that last migration, even though each step along the way, it may not be degraded audibly.
That's a different problem, and that one doesn't keep me up at night. bit preservation is a highly evolved science. If you talk about the idea of copying files over and over, and you talk to IT people, they look at you like you've got three eyes. Bit preservation's been solved. Bit preservation was solved 40 years ago. And if you have any doubt about that, about whether you're going to be able to recover a random file, when the chairman of Goldman Sachs is subpoenaed by the SEC to produce an email from 1994, it shows up. You know, so this isn't some subtle change. The changes in data integrity tend to be very catastrophic. But this happens before the file gets written. This is much earlier in the process. And these problems aren't going to happen with just copying files. Yeah?
So it's sounding like there's a minimum or maximum integrity level, depending on how you look at it, whether it's a minimum or a maximum, that's acceptable at the current state of the art. And I wonder whether that's something that either we or AES or somebody else should be looking at as part of a specification or a set of standards.
I think it would be interesting to develop configurations. This is where manufacturers, you know, back in the day when I first was buying digital audio workstations, you didn't go one place and buy your PC and someplace else and buy your card and someplace. You bought a turnkey system. You paid through the nose for that, down to the hard drive. And it was over issues like this. Whereas now, everything is being bought based on how inexpensive it can be had for. And something's got to give. And this is where it's been giving. And I think that since we haven't all been missing all of this information, if this resolution is being lost so routinely, how, you know, is our striving for ever better and better bit depth and higher resolutions really where our efforts belong? You know, if we haven't been hearing this on a day-to-day basis, it's not that this stuff isn't important. I think that this should all be solved. But is it where most of our efforts should be going? Because all of this is nothing compared to a bad analog playback. We're like miles and miles away from something like that. And you know, any number of institutions I've walked into to see what they were doing and do consulting work, and you find they've been transferring disks and they've got 20 dB of headroom in them. That's a far more important problem than the resolution.
But what I'm getting at is that this may be potentially a tool that we as audio preservation professionals can use to be able to make it to tell potential clients, potential, the institutional management, this is the reason that you have to spend this kind of money to do it instead of doing it on a on a sound blaster.
And the same thing goes with hiring hiring talented staff.
There's some value to creating a set of either minimum or maximum.
But it's going to be out of date as soon as it's published. This is such a moving target. You find that you buy your Apogee Rosetta's commonly used box, right? And then there's no OS 10.5 driver for it. What do you do? Because the target moves all the time. It requires persistent vigilance. All right, I got one more. Bill.
Did you notice any patterns in this problem happening on the higher end of the spectrum? What I mean by that, was it like happening more often in 24-bit 96 than it was happening at, like, say, 16-44-1?
There is, in bit depth, it happened irrespective of sample rate. If the program wanted to fudge about the resolution in amplitude, it didn't matter. I would say we didn't see any hard correlation, although I don't have any analysis of this, to see whether it was better at 44 than at 96, where we would expect to see it in dropped samples. What I think happens with the dropped samples is usually you're depending upon the host, and the host is busy. Whether the host is updating the clock or answering knocks on the door from the Ethernet or downloading your email because you're bored and just sitting there and doing it. The operating system's got a lot going on. And the moment it needs to go out to the hard drive and say, are you okay? A couple of samples get dropped. And what I also find very troubling about the drops of data, which are just as common as the truncation, is the video guys would never be able to stand this. video is a much higher bandwidth, much higher tolerances for the data rate, and you drop a frame, you see that really fast. But, you know, we're dropping audio data pretty much willy-nilly. All right, I'm going to give Aaron enough time. And, you know, I'm here all week. If anybody wants to...